listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Tonight we are honored to have Joseph Stiglitz to discuss Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy in conversation with LA Times editor-at-large Jim Newton. Professor Stiglitz is going to explain to us what we fondly or not so fondly call the Great Recession, and hopefully we'll leave here tonight feeling really, really great. How did America export bad economics, bad policies, and bad behavior to the rest of the world, and what of our response to it when the market seized up? In his new book, Professor Stiglitz lays bare the true magnitude of the events of the past 2 years and, as well, outlines a way forward. Jim Newton, we are very honored to have Jim to interview Professor Stiglitz tonight. He is a 20-year veteran of the LA Times, where he has worked as a reporter, editor, and bureau chief, and has covered, among other beats, the LA Police Department, the administration of Mayor Richard Reardon, federal law enforcement, and state and local politics. He was part of the LA Times coverage of the Los Angeles riots in 1992 and the earthquake of 1994, both of which were awarded Pulitzer Prizes to the staff. He's also an author. He wrote Justice for All, Earl Warren and the Nation He Made, a critically acclaimed best-selling biography of the former Chief Justice. He's currently working on a book about Eisenhower, and he is currently a senior fellow with UCLA's School of Public Affairs. They will be having a conversation. Jim Newton will be introducing our distinguished speaker, after which they will, after their conversation, invite you into the conversation, and we will circulate a microphone so that we can all hear you and because we record for podcast. And afterwards, Professor Stiglitz will be signing his books in the lobby. Please welcome Jim Newton to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you, Louise. Joseph Stiglitz was warning of trouble for the U.S. economy back when George Bush was a part owner of a baseball team. And Bernie Madoff was a good guy. Through those years, as Americans piled up earnings in the stock market and as Clinton produced balanced budgets and then surpluses, imagine surpluses, Professor Stiglitz was a rare voice warning that securitizing mortgages carried profound risks for both buyers and sellers as they entered into highly complex and difficult-to-value arrangements. Today, as you all know, those risks have come due with crushing consequence for the country and the world, and consequences that are being felt with particular intensity here in California and in Los Angeles. Products and devices that broadened home ownership for a time have instead triggered waves of foreclosures and cataclysmic job losses. And the price for those misjudgments sit just outside the door to this library. 1 in 5 Angelenos who want a job today are without one. Home prices, as many of you know, have plummeted, along with retail sales and middle-class jobs. You certainly, you're hearing from someone who works for the Tribune Corporation, and I can tell you, we feel it here, too. California is careening from crisis to crisis. Not all of that is a product of the economy, but much of it has been exacerbated by falling incomes and revenues. And state and local governments hover on the edge of insolvency. Just last week, city officials here in Los Angeles who too long resisted the seriousness of this threat, proposed laying off 3,000 to 4,000 city workers, none of whom, it should be noted, did anything to precipitate this crisis. Professor Stiglitz's warnings have not always made him popular. The guy who shouts that the sky is falling can be irritating right up to the moment that the sky hits you in the head and you realize he was right. The question now is, what do you do then? If you're smart, I would argue you listen. What Professor Stiglitz has to say in his new book will not make audiences any more comfortable than his warnings through the 1990s did. He's blisteringly critical of President Bush's response to the onset of the recession in 2007 and 2008, or rather, President Bush's utter lack of response to that crisis until it was too late. But he is also deeply disappointed in the failure of the Obama administration, as he sees it, to grasp the mistakes of its predecessors and thus miss the opportunity to respond in a creative, forceful, and transformative way. So we are here tonight to listen to what we should have heard more than a decade ago, to which I can only say better late than never. You are about to hear from one of the world's leading analysts of the global economy, a Keynesian for our times, a professor at Columbia University and former chief economist of the World Bank, a brash, clear thinker, the 2001 winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, and despite all that, I have to say an uncommonly cheery fellow. ladies and gentlemen, I'm happy to introduce to you Professor Joseph Stiglitz. Well, Professor, do you want to start and talk just a little bit about what you said in the book and some of the findings that the people here should ought to know?
Well, it's very hard to summarize a big book in a few minutes, but this book is different from a lot of the other books that have been written in response to the crisis. There have been a rash of books. Most of them are journalistic accounts. Not that there's anything wrong with journalism.
No, sir.
But they're stories of who did what when, what happened in the 4 days that Lehman Brothers collapsed or Bear Stearns collapsed. What would have happened if this key person hadn't had to go to the bathroom at a key moment and negotiations fell apart and that kind of detail. This is really much more a book about ideas, a battle of ideas that raged before the crisis, led to a number of decisions like deregulation and not having regulations that were needed, decisions that ultimately resulted in the crisis, and ideas that helped shape the response to the crisis, a response which I think is quite clear now was inadequate and which will result in the downturn being much longer and deeper than it needed to have been. And then the final thing that I try to do in the book, besides telling them what they should have done, and besides pointing out now that they didn't do what they should have done, what it is that we should be doing, what I try to put this is in the context of you might say a longer run vision, because one of the mistakes that they made, that the decision makers, policy makers made, was that they focus too much on just putting out the fire, in a sense. And the result in the financial markets is that today we have a financial system that is in some ways more dysfunctional than it was before the crisis. And we should have had a vision. Our long-run problems have continued to get worse. And so what I've tried to do is link how we should have shaped our short-run policy with a vision of long-run, of the long-run problems and what we could have should have be doing about those.
And can I ask you, where are we today in the arc of this recession and recovery? You note in the book, you write, the best that can be said for the economy was that by the fall of 2009, it seems to be at the end of a free fall, a decline without an end in sight. But the end of a free fall is not the same as a return to normalcy. Does that still describe where we are?
Very much so. And in fact, the news that keeps coming along is continuing to be dismal. Economists are called the dismal science, and we've been having a field day. We've been having a field day in the last couple of years. But, every day you pick up the paper, and just for instance, in the Wall Street Journal today, it pointed out that the decline in credit in the United States in 2009 was the largest since 1942. These are striking numbers that one out of four mortgages are underwater, that it's still the case that more than one out of five Americans who would like a full-time job can't get one. But what is increasingly apparent, I mentioned this in the book, but it's now getting into the, you might say, popular discourse, is the fact that while we've talked a lot about residential mortgages, the fact that the number of foreclosures expected in 2010 is actually larger than in 2009. The number of bank failures, there were 140 banks that went bankrupt in 2009. The number expected in 2010 is expected to be larger. There's a whole new set of problems becoming coming to the fore, and that is commercial real estate. There's about $500 billion of commercial real estate loans, mortgages, that have to be rolled over each year in the next 3 to 5 years. And just like a large fraction of the mortgages, residential mortgages, are underwater. People owe more than the value of the house, something probably, unfortunately, so many people here know about. The same thing is true in the commercial real estate. And but there, it's much more difficult because the amounts are so large. And first example of this just came up in New York a few weeks ago, where one of the largest projects was called the Stuyvesant Project, and a multi-billion-dollar project went bankrupt. And we're likely to see more and more. So, you know, when a house goes into foreclosure, you're talking about $100,000 or $200,000, $300,000, $500,000. These are multi-billion-dollar failures.
And why, I was specifically interested in you mentioning that you expect bank failures to accelerate this year, too. Given the amount of resources and time and energy that's gone into saving banks, why is that continuing to accelerate?
Well, that's actually one of my main criticisms of what Obama administration did. It should have realized that our financial system had not functioned well in the years before the crisis, that it had to be downsized. You know, 40% of all corporate profits were in the financial sector in 2007 and the years before the crisis. But it didn't think about how to restructure it, what part of the financial system it wanted to expand and what part should be contracted. It had to contract, but some parts ought to have contracted more. So it poured money into the big banks, which were speculating, gambling, depending on what you call it, but were not lending. And so as we were pouring money into the bank, these big banks, they were pouring money out in dividends and bonuses, money that we thought was supposed to be recapitalized in the banks and being lent on, it wasn't going there. But meanwhile, while we were focusing on these big banks, Goldman Sachs, Citibank, other big banks, we weren't paying enough attention to the smaller banks. And so the too big to fail banks were too big to be allowed to fail. And so we saved them. But the smaller banks we've allowed to fail. And the real worry is that as the problems in commercial real estate come to the fore, more and more of those are also going to fail. But why that's so important is that small and medium-sized businesses, which are the engines of job creation or job destruction, are not going to be able to get the credit they need to hire people, to expand. They're forced to contract, in fact. And that is one of the factors that is contributing to the weaknesses in the American economy that we've talked about.
And absent a more forceful or creative response along the lines that you describe in your book, how long are we in this for?
Well, partly the answer depends on what they do if they listen to this.
Well, then we're done in a couple of weeks. Right?
Well, but the what are now becoming, you might say, the general consensus on the forecast, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, is talking about it will not be until the middle of the decade before unemployment returns to a more normal level. But I think that's optimistic. And I think people have to realize that economies do not necessarily recover very quickly. Japan had very rapid growth for decades after World War II. But then they did the same thing that we did. They liberalized. They got rid of a lot of the regulations. And then the same thing that happened here. They had a bubble. They had a more dramatic bubble. Because it was more dramatic, when it broke, it had more severe consequences. The bubble broke at the end of the 80s. They were just beginning to recover before the current crisis. So they had almost two decades of stagnation. A few years when they started to grow. And then, interestingly, in 1997, the deficit hawks came to the fore, and they responded to try to reduce the deficit, and they went back into recession. So some of the same kinds of forces, discussions that we are hearing in the United States went on in Japan, and unfortunately, the way they played out contributed to extending the length of time. I hope that doesn't happen.
Right, of course. But I mean, that actually may be a good segue to my next question, which was I noticed in Newsweek, and it's the annoyingly titled feature, "We Read It So You Don't Have To," about books, referred to you as an economic Cassandra. How do you respond to that?
Well, I guess I would prefer being other words, more a realist. I mean, one of the difficulties in this area is that most of the people, not all, but most of the people who are being quoted in the newspapers, referred to on the talk shows, have an agenda. Those in Wall Street, who were traditionally the gurus about economics, want to sell stock. And people aren't going to go buying if they think the world is about to have major problems, that there's a lot of uncertainty. So, they obviously have an incentive to try to talk up the economy. And the administration has a little bit the same thing. They genuinely want the economy to perform better. They're going to be graded in the end by right. how well the economy performs. And there is this view that's becoming even more popular that confidence is important. It is important. But the view that if all we can, if we can just get confidence up, make people feel better, they'll go back to the shopping mall. And if they go back to the shopping mall, we will recover. Now, what's wrong with that are a couple of things. First, we were consuming too much. What we were doing was not sustainable. Our America savings rate was down to zero. And you don't have to be a genius to know that no country can sustain long-term growth with a household savings rate of zero. And, as one of my predecessors as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors said, that which is not sustainable won't be sustained. And
that's why they made him the chair of the council.
So, what we were doing was not sustainable, and we shouldn't go back to that. But the other point that's wrong with it is, it's good to have to talk and try to get people to feel good. But, talk can only get you so far. If you have negative equity in your mortgage, you're not going to feel very, very good.
You're not going to go to the mall.
You're not going to go to the mall.
Right.
And the fact that we had a bubble is reality. And no amount of talk is going to change that. The fact that because of that bubble, people borrowed more than they should have is part of the reality. So it seems to me that part of our mistake in the last year, even since the crisis came to the fore, was that we didn't want to do a cold-headed analysis of what was wrong. There was really just too much hope that somehow, if we just felt good, all these problems would disappear, but it obviously won't. And it seems to me, one of the reasons for writing the book is to say, look, we have to get a grasp of what really has happened if we're going to fix it. and if we're going to go ahead and return our economy to dynamic growth.
Mm-hmm. You make toward the end of the book, you have a very arresting comparison, comparing the fall of the Berlin Wall to the fall of Lehman Brothers. I forget the exact quote, I didn't write it down, but that the fall of Lehman Brothers is the equivalent moment in the history of a kind of unfettered capitalism as the fall of the Berlin Wall was to communism. I wonder if that's the case, then what comes after the fall of Lehman Brothers in the same way that we sort of know what came after the fall of the Berlin Wall?
Well, the point I was trying to make there was that the fall of the Berlin Wall was made it clear that a system of economic organization in which the government did everything could not work. You couldn't have central planning. You couldn't have all that done by government. And market fundamentalism was the opposite mistake. It was that unfettered markets would solve every problem, and that you ought to strip away regulations because markets by themselves are not efficient, stable, self-correcting. And it was that idea that was laid behind not only, you know, if you're going to have regulation, first strip it away, but if you're going to have it, make sure it's self-regulation. Well, that's an oxymoron. And what comes after this is some form of balance between the market and the state. And that in a nutshell, is really the main thesis of the book, that we have to find that balance. You know, in the history of capitalism, financial crises have been very common. And they happen every few years, except in one period. And that was the 30 years or so, three decades or so, after the Great Depression. And why? Because after the Great Depression, there was a commission, the Pecora Commission was established, and people thought about what had gone wrong. And they passed some very strong laws trying to prevent another occurrence. The Securities and Exchange Commission, Glass-Steagall, which separated commercial banks and investment banks, a whole series of laws. And remarkably, you know, we think we have today a very negative view often of government, but it worked. And we succeeded for that very long period of avoiding any financial crisis. And we should remember this period, which includes the quarter century after World War II, was a period of very rapid growth, very high innovation in the real sector, and a very rapid increases of standard of living of America. So in every dimension, it was a very successful period. But somehow, as we got further and further from the Great Depression, it faded. And we thought we had a new economy, that we were so much smarter than those older generations. And so began the period of stripping away the regulations. And what was, to me, as chief economist of the World Bank, so interesting, you could see all over the world the consequences, because these ideas were ideas not just in the United States, but there were similar ideas going around all over the world. And you started having financial crisis after financial crisis and bailout after bailout. There were about 125 in the 25, 30 years after 1980. And it was more unusual for countries not to have a crisis than to have one. And so the only thing that's unusual about this crisis is, first, it's here in the home of capitalism. It's here in the United States. And because we do things better, bigger than every, it's a bigger crisis than any of the other ones that have preceded us. And therefore, it's more difficult to get out of. And it is clearly the worst crisis since the Great Depression.
You mentioned almost in passing there the sort of skittishness that many Americans have toward government and the notion of government involvement in the economy, a skittishness that's really not shared in many European countries, for instance. I have two questions there. So what do you attribute that to? And second, as a matter of moving forward, how do you overcome that to embark on the kinds of reforms that you'd like to see happen?
Well, I think it part comes as from our self-image of rugged individualism. It partly comes from a remarkable sales job that was done by President Reagan and some successors, that government was the problem. But to me, you know, part of the way of overcoming it is an explanation, an understanding of, in fact, why it is that governments have to play an important role. You know, we've been talking about, in some sense, the restraining role, preventing crises, and every stable economy has a government trying to prevent the excesses of the kind that we've just seen. What's interesting is that even the bankers, even the banks that normally say we don't believe in government, were asking for government to bail them out because they knew that if the government didn't bail them out, they'd be all dead. You know, and they know the whole system would have collapsed. And that by itself should be very telling. If it were, you know, we should remember that were it not for the government actions, they may not have been perfectly well designed, but were, if it were not for what the government did, we would be in a deep depression now. And it saved us from that. I'm very critical because it didn't do it as well as it should have. It was, you know, there were many flaws. We're going to be deeper in debt. Money went to people that it shouldn't have gone. But still, if it hadn't been for the government's rescue, we would be in a deep recession, a depression, beyond the deep recession we are now. But the other point that I would make is that the government also has a very creative role, a very important role on the innovative side. You know, the contrast the innovation. Well, what was the most important innovation of the last part of the last century? The internet.
Thankfully, I was glad that wasn't a quiz.
As a teacher, we always rhetorical questions. So, you know, it was the big innovation. Who financed that? The government. And, you know, after it did the basic research, after it did the innovation, it turned it over to the private sector to implement it, to bring it to market. But the government has to do all the basic research, or at least most of the basic research, on which all the other, what the private sector depends. We see it in medical, in every sector, and it's not just now. It goes back to the 19th century. The first telegraph line was financed by the U.S. government. All the increases in agricultural productivity that transformed America, that enabled us to move from dependence on agriculture into manufacturing, was all financed by the U.S. government. So it's played a very constructive role in innovation and increasing the productivity of our economy. I mean, let me mention just one more example back to finance, because it helps show the contrasting perspectives. When I was on the Council of Economic Advisors, one of the things that, you know, that I noticed was that while we were in a period of very low inflation, there were no products that financial products that individuals could buy to protect them against inflation. And while, you say, inflation was low then, who knows what it would be like in 30, 40 years when people retire. And right now, a lot of Americans are feeling anxious about inflation as they see the deficit increase and the ballooning of the Fed's balance sheet. Well, the private sector didn't come forward with a product. We came forward, I argued we ought to create inflation index bonds called TIPS. The private sector, the financial sector, resisted this innovation. Not only didn't they do it, they tried to stop us from doing it. And I sort of scratched my head and you know, wondered why. And finally, I figured it out. It was actually fairly simple. The problem was that in a few other countries where they had introduced inflation index products, bonds, people bought them and held them for retirement. You say, that's a good thing. But the financial sector doesn't make money that way. They make money from people buying and selling, betting on whether inflation rate is going to go up or down. In other words, they make money out of transactions. And to them, this was a terrible idea that people would buy and hold something until they got retired. They weren't going to be able to get anything out of it. And that's why they resisted it. And, you know, I've seen lots, and, you know, it helps us understand why much of the innovation that they had, that they brought forward, was not actually constructive, didn't actually help people manage the risk of home ownership, actually made it more difficult, didn't help our economy become more efficient, and why they resisted innovations that would do that.
Is there any way to know what percentage of these home, you make the strong point in the book that some large number of homeowners were misled by financial institutions into buying mortgages that they couldn't afford. Is there any way to know what percentage of the homes that are underwater today fall into that category, people who are misled as opposed to those who merely made a bad decision?
No, it's very difficult. There are actually three categories. There is one category of actually fraudulent behavior. And we know it occurred. There's an interesting website that the FBI has created where they've been tracing fraudulent behavior in mortgage markets, and it's very large. So, you know, they have a special office on this. But those are the guys who stepped over the law.
Right.
Most of what went on was just bad advice. And then, of course, there were people who, on their own, made bad judgments. In the book, I talk about some of the worst examples of bad advice. There were a group of participants in the market called mortgage brokers. These are the guys who you would go to for advice about which mortgage to buy. You know, mortgage A versus mortgage B. And what it was discovered is that they were being paid by the companies originating the mortgage to steer them to more expensive products that were not serving their interest. They were, you know, deliberately, I should say, you know, the homeowner thought he was working for them, but they were actually working for the other side.
Is that criminal? Sounds like it.
It sounds like it, but I don't, you know, our laws, you know, remember in this period, there's a lot of what I call predatory lending going on, and there were some attempts to stop it, but the lobbyists from the financial industry were successful in stopping the efforts to stop it. But, you know, when you ask the question, it's a good question of how much was this innocent and how much of it was not. The difficulty of making that judgment is illustrated by the fact that the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, it's not clear that he understood what it meant to manage risk. I mean, here is the guy who's supposed to be giving advice about managing risk, right? And he gave the advice to people to take these variable rate mortgages. What he said was, if they had taken these variable rate mortgages rather than the traditional fixed rate mortgage, if they had done that 10 years earlier, they would have saved a lot of money. Well, that's true. But that's because interest rates had never been brought down to the level of 1%. And markets always look in the past to make judgments about the future. And so how could they have anticipated that interest rates would go down to 1%? But it was because of what he did that they were saving those who took out variable rate mortgages. But then you ask the question, if interest rates are at 1%, which way are they probably going to go? And you don't have to have a PhD to figure out that it's more than likely than not that they're going to go up. Now, that means that if people borrow as much as they can when interest rates are at the lowest possible, when interest rates return to a more normal level, which would be in his purview, a lot of people are going to get into trouble. And if a lot of people get into trouble and they have to sell their house, the house prices are going to go down, and you're going to have a disaster. The bubble is going to break. He should have said that. But he didn't understand that.
Didn't understand it or just didn't say it?
I think he didn't understand it.
Interesting.
And or at least didn't think about all the consequences. Part of the reason was that, and this is something sort of a kind of cognitive dissonance, he believed that markets were efficient. And so he believed that you couldn't have a bubble, because if you had a bubble, that would be evidence of an inefficient market. So he didn't worry about the kind of phenomena that I'm just describing, where because you have a bubble and then everybody tries to sell, it would fall. That was a concept that was beyond his way of thinking. And when he was asked about, is there a bubble, he said, no, just a little froth. But if he had understood, the basic economic argument is a very simple one. If markets are efficient, then on average, you're going to pay the same amount whether you take a variable rate or a fixed rate. That's what you mean by efficient markets. He should have understood that. So that's why I say it's a cognitive dissonance. At the same time, he says, I believe in efficient markets. And at the same time, he's telling people, you will save money if you go to a variable rate mortgage. Now, how could he expect that a first-time homeowner is going to be better at forecasting interest rates than guys who do it for business? It was absurd. And then the final point is, he should have realized that what he should have advised people is which product is best for managing your risk. That the market, if the market is efficient, you should focus on just one thing, your ability to bear risk. And the answer to that is very clear. Variable rate mortgages were very risky. Beyond, and homeowners, particularly lower income, middle income homeowners, should have shifted that risk to the market. And he advised them the opposite. So, to answer your question, to what extent was it fraud and to what extent was it misjudgment? Mm-hmm. The misjudgments came from the very top. And so no wonder then that if those guys at the top didn't understand what they were doing, no wonder that ordinary homeowners, first-time homeowners, didn't understand what was going on.
Let me ask you about President Obama. You were an Obama supporter. Obviously, you don't seem to take any great relish in the critique you have of the administration here, but you make it. And in fact, not only do you accuse him of merely rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, it's only slightly rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. I guess the real question is, how much further could or should he have gone, and what specifically could or should he have done up to this point that would have reset the fundamentals in a more constructive way? And then the second half of that question is sort of now, given that that hasn't happened, going forward, how much ability does he have to still do what's necessary?
Let me first answer what he should have done. And there's an issue of politics of what was possible that I'll come to at the end. In terms of what he should have done, for instance, it was very clear that we needed a much bigger stimulus than the $800 billion that he called for. Even the chairman of his own Council of Economic Advisors said $1.2 trillion. Paul Krugman and I and others were calling for a larger stimulus. We also said it should have been better designed. One of the things that I argued very strongly for was that there should be aid to the states who were going to face very difficult time. It wasn't yet as dramatic as it is today, but anybody who understood the economics of this, it was so clear. Property values were going down, property tax revenues were going to go down, state income taxes were going to go down. The states have a balanced budget framework, which means when their revenues go down, they either have to cut back expenditures or raise taxes. That the needs that are going to be put in response to the crisis were going to increase the demands on the states, and yet their capacity to respond to them was weakened. It was very important to get money out into the economy very quickly. And the best way to do it was to prevent contraction of the states. And the contraction of the states is like a negative multiplier, a negative stimulus. So while he was having an $800 billion two-year positive stimulus, there was a $400 billion negative stimulus going on at the state level. And he could have undone that, or at least undone a large part of it, by filling in that gap. So those are examples of what he should have done on the stimulus. It was much better than what happened before, which was nothing, but it still wasn't enough. The second thing was homeowners. You know, when the crisis began and the Bush administration tried pouring money into the banks, kind of trickle-down economics, the view that if you poured enough money into the banks, somehow the rest of the economy would be saved. You know, I said we ought to try trickle-up economics, that we ought to help the people at the bottom, and then the banks, if we can help homeowners not lose their homes, the banks would be helped. I said it was a little bit like giving a mass blood transfusion to a patient suffering from internal hemorrhaging and not doing anything about the underlying problem. So he finally did something about the foreclosures, the homeowners, but it was very little. And that's why the number of foreclosures that is expected in 2010, 2.5 to 3.5 million, is more than in 2009 and 2008. So it's clear, wasn't enough. In particular, he didn't do anything about the more than one out of four homeowners who are underwater. The reason is very simple. The banks didn't want him to. And the reason the banks didn't want him to is they didn't want to admit that they had made bad loans. And if you had to restructure the loans, they'd have to write down the mortgages to a more, they'd have to realize some of these losses. Their response was just the opposite. They said, let's pretend that we don't have a problem. And so they succeeded in getting an accounting change to make their books less transparent, allowing them to keep on their books mortgages that were not paying as if they were going to be paid eventually. The third thing that he should have done concerns the way he handled the banks. There are two parts of this. Mentioned before that, money was pouring into the banks, but it was done without conditions. You know, when we had a welfare reform in 1996 for the poor, we said, if you're going to get money, you have to either look for a job or go into training. But when we poured in money into the banks, we didn't put any conditions, and as a result of that was they didn't do the lending that was promised, but instead paid out a lot of the money into dividends and into bonuses. So no wonder, with money going out, lending wasn't rekindled. But the other problem is the financial system was not restructured in a way that would have directed, that would have improved the functioning of the financial system. So more of it would be directed at creating new jobs, new enterprises. You know, parts of our financial system are the best in the world. The venture capital firms that are in, California are the envy of the rest of the world, but they're now short of funds. So we didn't have a vision of what kind of a financial system that we needed or we wanted. And so when we were pouring money in, we didn't reshape it. And the result of it is that the financial system is actually more dysfunctional than it was in 2007. The other piece is a long story, but a very simple point. I said before, what caused the crisis, or what was central to the crisis, was deregulation and not adopting regulations to respond to the new problems. The problem credit default swaps, where, you know, the failure of one company, AIG, cost American taxpayers $178 billion. Now, that's it. You know, when you say that amount, it trips off your lips and you don't realize how much money $178 billion is to one company. You know, when I was in the Council of Economic Advisors, we would have discussions days and days, months, about how to spend a billion here or a billion there. You know, we knew that some of our inner city schools were decrepit and needed to be reconstructed. But Rubin, who was then Secretary of Treasury, said, we don't have enough money. we knew that we had, you know, Bush knew, everybody knew that we had problems in our healthcare system, and that poor children were not getting access to healthcare. But President Bush vetoed the bill to provide health insurance for children, a few billion dollars, saying we didn't have enough money. And yet, a little bit later, we found $178 billion. Now, just to give you a flavor of what it means, it's more than the foreign aid that we'll give to Africa over a quarter of a century. Went to one company. And then that money just went out. We know where it went. They didn't want to tell us. But eventually, you know, they claimed it was a state secret. We now know why they didn't want to tell us. Because the largest single amount went directly to Goldman Sachs. And then the next bit went to some foreign banks. The point, I guess, I want to make is that in what we still haven't done is to adopt regulations that would restore confidence on our part in the financial system and to make sure that we don't have a recurrence of this kind of a crisis.
Do you hear any change in tone? I mean, the president recently has been sort of more notably populist with respect to the bonuses, for instance. Is there any evidence of substantive change on behalf of the administration in terms of how it's approaching these to accompany what seems to have been some rhetorical change?
Well, we don't have the changes haven't gone through Congress, and until we know that happens, we can't be sure about with what force what efforts will have been exerted to get it through. But the proposals themselves represent a dramatic change from where the administration was, say, 6 months earlier. Just a couple of things. For instance, they finally began to talk about banks that are too big to fail. That's a problem, and it should be obvious it's a problem. You know, the one thing that economists agree on is incentives matter. And if you're too big to fail, you have distorted incentives. If you gamble and you win, you walk off with the profits. If you gamble and lose, the taxpayers pick up the tab. And we saw that. Clear that we need to change that rule. I testified to Congress on this issue back in the fall, and nothing was being proposed from the administration. It was an interesting testimony because you had people from the left, right, and center all saying the same thing. So the good news is the administration has at least begun to propose something like a tax on the highly leveraged large banks, recognizing that leverage itself represents risk, and that means a higher risk that the taxpayer is going to have to bear costs. The other proposal, very important one, addresses the issues of conflicts of interest, which are rife throughout the industry. In fact, sometimes I think they don't understand the word conflict of interest. there is a proposal to restrict proprietary trading on the part of the depository institutions, the commercial banks. And, you know, this is something that Volcker argued for. And what's interesting, a letter, I think it was yesterday, maybe it was the day before, in the Wall Street Journal, signed by five of the former Secretary's Treasury, both parties, saying this is something that, in effect, was obvious. You know, it was a no-brainer. And yet it's meeting resistance. And the idea is very, very simple. If you're trading for yourself and at the same time have the responsibility of managing money for other people, and if you make a loss and the government has to pick up the tab, that's a problem. And say, you know, it's okay for you to trade on your own account, but don't do it mixed in
with everybody else.
With the rest of your commercial bank. You know, have a separate institution do that. But what I guess I would also say is that these proposals, very important, are not enough. They're about a third of the way. They don't do anything about the credit default swaps, the derivatives that I talked about before. One of the very big issues that European governments are focused on are the incentive pay to the banks, the bankers. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a very simple point. I said before that the one thing economists agree on is incentives matter, and the banks seem to say that. You look at the incentive structures, and they're designed to encourage short-sighted behavior and excessive risk-taking. So why should we be surprised at what we saw? In fact, I jokingly say that I was a little bit worried before the crisis because it wasn't obvious to most people that there was such excessive risk-taking, short-sighted behavior going on. And if it didn't occur, we'd have to rewrite our textbooks. The good news is we don't have to rewrite our textbooks. The bad news is, of course, the country has suffered a great deal.
I know we want to turn to the audience, but I have one more before I let you go, which is just to ask, what are the foreseeable consequences of the deficits that are being amassed over these years? How concerned should we be about deficits these days?
Yeah, that's a good question. Let me first say, you know, I'm very critical of what I call deficit fetishism. the real issue is how you spend the money. So, for instance, if the government spends money on education, infrastructure, technology, it stimulates the economy today, and it leads to more growth in the future. The banks were very short-sighted in their approach to everything. And, you know, that's one of my criticisms. And now, unfortunately, many in the financial markets are, again, being very short-sighted. We should be focusing not on the deficit today, but on the long-run national debt. Mm-hmm. Well, if you take, if you spend money today on these investments, all it takes is a 5 to 6% return, and the long-term national debt will actually be lower. For obvious reason, because you help the economy grow today, and that gives you more tax revenue. You help the economy grow in the long run, and that gives you more tax revenue. And that says, if you're just focused on the national debt, these are good spending. These are good deficits, let alone all the other social benefits of job creation, and, you know, all the other benefits that can accrue from that kind of spending. Let me put it a slightly different way. If we look at the accounts of any firm, we would never look just at what a firm owes. You look at the balance sheet. Look at what it owes on the one hand, and you look at its assets on the other. And what you want to look at is the difference between the assets and what it owes, the liabilities. Next, the net worth. If you borrow more to buy assets and you buy good assets, your net worth grows and you're stronger. But for some reason, the financial sector, when it looks at the government, only looks at one side of the balance sheet, always ignores the other side. And that's just bad economics. So to me, the lesson is a very simple one. We do need to care about it. But the lesson is not to cut back our spending, but to make sure that the way we spend the money yields a high return. So what are some of the lessons from that? Well, the first lesson is the way we bailed out the banks was a very foolish investment. We gave money to the banks. They gave us preferred shares. But we know from the Congressional Oversight Panel that we were cheated. We got 67 cents in preferred shares back from the banks for every dollar we gave them. In some of the deals, we got less than 50 cents on the dollar. Now, obviously, if we'd gotten a dollar for a dollar, the national debt in the long run would be lower. The fact that we were cheated by the banks means that our national debt will be higher. Now, as you know, I wrote a book called The $3 Trillion War, and that's another area where, you know, whatever you may judge the benefits of the security, I think that actually it doesn't bring those benefits. But what is clear is that war spending doesn't lead to increased growth, but does increase our liability, our deficit side. And, you know, the spending on weapons of mass destruction, spending on these hundreds of billions of dollars on weapons that don't work against enemies that don't exist is a waste of money. You know, you're working on, we were talking, you know, you're working on a book on Eisenhower and his famous speech on the military-industrial complex, you know, reflects those concerns that he had. And that
take
was
some notes.
But you know, we are now seeing the consequences of those concerns, and the result of that, you know, that's an example of the kind of spending that increases the deficit and the national debt without having a corresponding asset that's being created.
Mm-hmm. With that, let's turn it over to some audience members. I think we have a microphone to pass around, so. Maybe right down here in front.
Could you help me understand what is ultimately going to get us out of the recession? For example, are we going to sell more manufactured products overseas? Or are we going to sell our services to Europe and Asia? Or are we counting on some innovations that might come along? Or what is it?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question, and one of the reasons why the recovery, let me go back a stage. You know, what had sustained the U.S. economy before the crisis was this bubble, and this bubble allowed us to consume beyond our means, and we did it because we thought we were all getting wealthier as our house prices went up. That led to savings being zero. Now that we realize we've been brought back to reality, savings is going to be higher. It's already about 4.5%. If it returns to a more normal historical average, it'll be about 7%. Could go beyond that. And that means there's an insufficient aggregate demand to keep our economy going at full employment. So then the question is, what is going to fill in the hole? Temporarily, what's filled in the hole has been government spending. And this is where your question is such a concern. The focus on deficit is leading to the view that we ought to cut back on government spending before something else kicks in. Now, a lot of people hoped that exports would. And in the East Asia crisis, those countries recovered very quickly because they were able to export. But they were a small part of the global economy, and the rest of the global economy was growing strongly. The problem is that this is a global downturn. And we, you know, Europe and the United States both can't export our way out of the crisis. So exports is not really going to be the solution. The solution, in my mind, has to be some form of investment. Now, one of the things that I find very disturbing about the way the global economy is today is that we have this huge excess capacity, people who are willing to work, unemployment all over the world, firms having more productive capacity than they're using. At the same time, from a global perspective, we have huge unmet needs. We have to retrofit the global economy for global warming. We have 2 billion people around the world living on less than $2 a day. These people need investment to increase their productivity. So as I look at it, you know, as an economist, I see there are huge needs for investment. And if there is that kind of investment globally, in a global economy, what matters is global demand. And, you know, it will find its way back to the United States in one way or another. So the real challenge is to figure out how to, you might say, actualize this potential, these needs. Now, that's another area where the financial sector has failed. And what it's supposed to be doing is looking around the world where the most important needs are, and channeling the funds from the places where the savings are, like in East Asia, and channeling them to where they're needed. It hasn't done that. And that's where I found such disappointment at what happened in Copenhagen. You know, most Americans looked at this, most people around the world looked at this, as a failure in addressing one of the most important global problems, global warming. But it was also a problem for our economic recovery. Had there been an agreement there that would raise the price of carbon emissions. Today it's zero. Most economists think it ought to be around $80 a ton. If it had raised the price of carbon, it would provide incentives for firms all over the world to invest to retrofit their their firms, to get more energy efficiency, to redesign their plants. As it is, it's led to paralysis. Firms in, say, the energy sector don't know what to do. Should they invest in another coal-fired plant that'll lead to more global warming? Well, that makes economic sense if nothing happens. But if something happens, it's not the best way to going forward. So what they're doing, waiting. And waiting is what leads to a very slow recovery. And so in a sense, Copenhagen was a global disaster, but it was also an economic disaster.
Well, yes, sir. Up in this third row there, yeah, in the blue shirt.
Thank you. My question is kind of looking at outside at the world, and they're not waiting for us to solve this problem exactly, although they're very interested, I'm sure. The countries that loan to us and on which, you know, we depend so much to be able to do any of this, it seems to me that, as you mentioned, Stein's Law, that if it's not sustainable, it's not going to continue. Well, how likely is it that the rest of the world is going to see us forever as the prime place to lend money? And if that changes, what impact is that going to have on our ability to address these things?
Yeah. The issue has already become a major source of concern. For those of you who haven't followed this, the dollar is the major reserve, has been traditionally the major reserve currency. So China, for instance, has reserves of about $2.3 trillion, of which somewhere between two-thirds, three-fourths are in dollars. It used to be almost all dollars, but the dollar is no longer viewed as a good store of value. It's very volatile, and people worry about where it's going. So they've been moving out gradually. The concerns, though, have grown markedly as our deficit, national debt, has increased. It was $5.7 trillion when President Bush became the president. By 2019, it's expected to be close to $20 trillion. It's a huge increase in a relatively short period of time. The balance sheet of the Fed has increased from $800 billion in normal years to over $2 trillion. So there's a lot of anxiety about the American economy. United States is used to lecturing other countries about economic policy. It's sort of, when you become Secretary of Treasury, it's one of the things that you do. You go around the world lecturing them about what they should do, and you say, follow our example. Well, we haven't been doing that recently, and our ability to do it is a little bit impaired. But we, for the first time, are in the situation where other countries have begun to lecture us. And the premier last March, China's premier, started lecturing the United States and saying, we don't want you to default on your dollars. And what they really were saying is, we don't want you to inflate away the value. We don't want you to do things that will decrease the value of your dollar. They're very worried. But going beyond that, this worry is translated into something that I think is actually good for the world economy, and that is a move away from the dollar reserve system. I was chair of the UN Commission for Reform of the Global Financial Monetary System, and our most important recommendation for the middle term was the creation of a new global reserve system. And I'll explain in a minute why we made that recommendation, but it is interesting how strong the resonance that our recommendation has had around the world. China has supported it, Russia, France, and part of the rationale is a very simple one. In the 21st century, to have the whole global financial system depend on the currency of one country is a little odd, especially if that country is having as much financial trouble and economic trouble as the United States. I think it will be good for the United States, but it will be difficult for us to adjust. We get one big benefit from it. We can borrow, at least we have been able to borrow, at very low interest rates. And that's what Americans focus on. It's a very strange situation where the richest, or what was the richest country in the world, can borrow at close to zero interest rate from much poorer countries. It's a kind of foreign aid to the United States, our ability to borrow at low interest rates. We've calculated the value of this foreign aid, and it's much larger. Our foreign aid from poor countries is much larger than the foreign aid that we give to poorer countries. So that's the advantage. But the disadvantage is that the flip side of this system is that we are exporting T-bills. That is to say, people are holding more and more of U.S. Treasury bills. And that has a couple effects. From a global perspective, it means that they're saving rather than spending. And we're talking about lots of money. The prime minister, and this problem really came to a head in the last 12 years. The way the IMF, the U.S. Treasury, mismanaged the global financial crisis of 97-98 led countries to say, we need to build up our reserves. The way the U.S. Treasury and the IMF, what they did is they came in, their misguided policies led downturns into recessions, recessions into depressions. Countries lost their economic sovereignty. The prime minister of one of the countries in East Asia in which this happened told me, he said, we were in the class of 97. We learned what happened if you don't have enough reserves. So it's understandable why they were doing that, but the consequence for global demand is that they're saving, and that makes for a weak global economy. So we need to have a new global reserve system. For America, it means when they're buying our T-bills, we're exporting T-bills rather than automobiles, and when you export T-bills, you don't create jobs. And so it contributes to the weak American economy. We managed to get through this until 2007, but it's going to be very hard to go back to the world of 2007 going forward. So to answer your question, I think we will be moving to a new global reserve system. It will impose a lot of discipline on us. We will have more difficult to borrow, but over the long run, it will be good for our economy and for the global economy.
I think we have time for two more relatively quick ones. How about here in the corner?
Yes, I appreciate your critical attitude toward deregulation, but it does not seem typical of a former chief economist of the World Bank. I was wondering if you could reflect on working there and whether you felt out of place at any point.
Well, actually, you know, when I went to the World Bank, there were a lot of differences of views. The World Bank is a little bit different from the IMF, where there was a much more of an orthodoxy. And one of the fun things of going to the World Bank was to discover how many people agreed with me that have been in the closet. And after I got there, they all came out of the closet. And actually, most of the economists actually supported my view. There were some problems, including with the U.S. Treasury, because the U.S. Treasury did not always support, no, that's putting it mildly, did not always support my views. I wrote very strongly, and the bank and much of what we advocated was very consistent with what I've been saying. One of the reasons that I had this strong view, on this issue, on privatization of Social Security, which many people have been advocating at the World Bank, was that I, having been in the Clinton administration, many things that the World Bank had been doing were the opposite of what we had been fighting for in the Clinton administration. You know, we fought not to privatize Social Security. Against some people who wanted to privatize it. And yet, here was the World Bank arguing for privatizing. And to me, this made no sense. So I had my little war inside the World Bank. I think I won inside the World Bank. And there were a lot of, maybe I'll just tell one little story that shows you the tenseness of the kind of thing that was going on. It was very exciting. There were a lot of crises going on. It was a wonderful time for an economist. And one of the best of these crises was in Russia. And the Russian government asked me to come. And the U.S. Treasury, which had been pushing what I thought at the time, some very misguided policies, was unhappy. So they were afraid that I would tell them something different from what they were telling them, and they were right. So Rubin called up the president of the World Bank and ordered him to not allow me to go to Russia. You know, we may believe in free speech, but and open discourse and, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom, but not in this area. So what did I have to do? I had to get Yeltsin to request that I go there so that I, you know, in the hierarchies, these things are very hierarchical. So Yeltsin trumped Rubin. So I did go, and I did give them the advice that the Treasury did not want me to give. So it was a very exciting period of time, and I learned a lot, and it did actually have a big effect in shaping my views on some of the issues that are talked about in free fall.
All right, one more. How about you, sir, in the back row there? Maybe there you go. Oh, I'm sorry, I meant back. I meant here, but yes, right there with his hand up there.
Good evening. Thank you for coming. I know you labeled yourself earlier as a realist. I also consider myself a realist. So my question to you is, looking at that, regulation played a big part in the in the financial crisis, and looking that the financial industry is one of the most powerful and wealthiest industries, or has one of the strongest and most powerful lobbyist groups. They have over around 600 lobbyists in Capitol Hill, and there's only around
many
five.
More than that.
Okay, 2-1, I think it was something like that.
5-1.
5-1. Even better. How do we expect them to pass comprehensive regulation that will prevent or even try to protect us from something like this happening again, or any type of systemic risk in the future?
Well, the talk I gave last night, somebody wanted me to end in an optimistic note, as opposed to a little bit dismal note that is more characteristic of an economist. And I come from the Midwest, and there's sort of a basic optimism in the Midwest. So let me give you first the optimistic view, and then...
Then you won't end on the optimistic view if you do
maybe
that.
Maybe I should...
Do whatever you want.
Fortunately, you know, we are a democracy. You know, the voters still matter. Campaign contributions play a very important role, and the revolving doors plays a very important role. But congressmen are very sensitive to the sentiment of voters. And the behavior of many within the financial sector has been so outrageous, and the incongruity between the return of the profits of some of the big banks, the big bonuses, and the suffering of the rest of America with the foreclosures, with the unemployment, is very difficult for many Americans to take. And it's manifesting itself in a variety of forms. Now, the challenge is to try to direct this frustration in a constructive way. And the constructive way is to say, what is it that caused the problem? And how do we fix it? And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, Free Fall. So in my more optimistic notes is that people will read this book. They will write to their congressmen. Maybe they will even march in Washington and say, we need regulations that will restructure our financial system, make it do what a financial system is supposed to do, and that we cannot afford another recurrence. And unless we reform the regulation, we will have another recurrence. So that's the more optimistic note.
You want one more? I want to go there. Okay. All right. To hear the pessimistic note, you have to meet him at the bookstore.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.